Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the New Books in Sociology podcast. I am Deidre Tyler, host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking with the author of Social Research Matter, Julia Brannon. How are you doing today?
I'm just fine, thank you.
I wonder if you could begin the interview by saying a few words about yourself and how you became interested in this project.
Well, I was approached by a publisher. I think because I've been working as a social science researcher for over 40 years, and research has been my full-time job throughout my working life. So that's how, and she asked me whether I'd be interested in writing about my life in research and about my work. So that's how I got to write this book.
Great. You know, you give us so much information here. I was wondering if you could explain what is meant by biographical contingencies and how they play a role in the phase of a life course of a researcher.
Well, life course contingencies, I should perhaps explain what that means. It means who your parents are, their occupations, where you grew up, the generation you belong to, the gender that you are. And all of these things are relevant to the way your life progresses. So in terms of my career as a researcher, I belong to a particular generation born in the middle of the 1940s in Britain. And at that time, even those with university degrees, who were a very tiny minority, as you can imagine, didn't expect to have a career. I mean, most of us, I suppose, didn't think much beyond marriage and motherhood. And in Britain at the time, there were no childcare facilities. So in shaping my own career, I would say that the women's movement in the 1970s, second wave feminism, coincided with the time that I was emerging from bringing up small children. And it was the impetus for my finding a meaningful job. And I chose to become a researcher. It and gave me the opportunity to foreground gender in my research and to examine the ways in which women were oppressed in the labour market and in the home at that time, and to do something about it. I thought, hopefully, in those days of social, you know, with where there was a strong emphasis on social change back in the 1970s, the Black Power movement and the women's movement. So I was attracted to research which was exploring women's lives. But biographical contingencies also caught up with me in my latter part of my career, because of my years at home, I was faced with the possibility of losing out. At the point when I hit retirement age, which in Britain was 65, I was still in the middle of a research career, or so I thought. At the point in my life when chronological age came up against, it wasn't the same thing as career age at all. But anyway, the end of the story was that shortly afterwards, the European Union abolished retirement age, and I was officially permitted to ask to go on working. So I hope that gives you an idea of biographical contingencies affecting a career in research.
Yes, it does. Thank you so much. Now, you talked about having no television in your home. How do you think that shaped your research questions?
I'm not sure I did. That's right. I don't remember writing that, because we did have a television, but not early on in my life. My father worked in the electronics industry, which was getting off the ground then, and we had a television on loan. So I don't remember that at all.
Okay.
But I would say that television, in terms of social science research, has been much less important than social media in terms of the way we communicate our research with the world.
Now, you did talk about mentors. Can you explain to the audience the importance of having a mentor?
Well, I did write about that, and I remember that. I talk about the people who mentored me at critical points in my career, when I was going for a promotion, turning my a book I'd written into a PhD, for example. I think I was lucky that these people kind of appeared on the scene to encourage me rather than my seeking them out as mentors. And I now think that mentoring can be important, but I also think it's a very individualistic thing and not particularly effective. And a colleague of mine who wrote a book on management in higher education in Ireland says that male academics that she interviewed didn't talk about mentors in relation to their progress and advancement up the ladders. Rather, they depended upon the actions of sponsors. They were protégés of senior academics who enabled them to secure promotion and positions. So I think that, you know, sponsorship is what gets you on in life, rather than having a mentor.
Can you give us a little information or maybe an example of a sponsorship?
Well, for example, if you're a junior researcher working to a senior researcher, they're in a position often to secure or to put you on a research grant application of their own, and therefore, you know, you don't have to just go on the open market to find a job. And I think that does happen. And the more people you have in women in senior positions, they're more able to do that for other women that they have who have worked with them in junior roles.
Thank you. What did you find about the work-life balance throughout your research?
In terms of whether I think things have got better or worse, in some ways, I think things have got better. There are now more senior women have a greater share of senior positions in universities and in other organizations. And there are now national and workplace policies concerning maternity leave, parental leave, and of course, diversity policies. There weren't those in the period in which, there were barely those, and they certainly didn't work very well. When I was at the beginning of my career. However, in the last 10, 15 years, I think the workplace has become much more intensive. In the social science research world, researchers tend to be of lower status than academics. Who are in teaching positions. Researchers are on short-term contracts in this country. And certainly in the past, this was also the case. But in the past, in a sense, we weren't expected to compete in the way that the academics did, who'd got tenured positions. And as a field worker, when I first started out in research, I had more freedom to and time for other responsibilities and activities, which I often worked, you know, on writing books and so forth in my spare time. And there was time to do that. And I think in the workforce today, and for mothers in particular, the pressures are huge. There's great competition within and between universities, which makes for a very individualistic and competitive work experience. And digital technologies have speeded up workplaces enormously in the whole work process so that we're never kind of off the job, so to speak. And the internal pressures for women to be the best possible mothers are much greater than they were when I was bringing up children. So I think the pressures on women today are enormous, and the discourse of choice that pervades everything does have its own constraints. You know, you feel you're never doing making the right choice or are doing quite enough. And however, having said all that, I think context makes a lot of difference. By that I mean it depends on the country you live in, the job that you have, the national policies that support gender equity, your line manager, whether you have a supportive partner, what kind of father that person is, and the quality and the cost of the childcare. And we did a number of studies in five different countries, and we looked at particular kinds of households. We tried to match the households in the different organizations and countries, and we showed how the particular mix of resources available to those parents made a difference in terms of their experience of being a working parent. So that, you know, to give an example, if you were a childcare worker in Sweden, the policies both at work and the context, the local context, was more supportive than if you were working in Britain, for example, in a similar kind of job. However, you know, the other aspects could come into play, like whether you happen to live near your job or not, which could make an enormous difference in terms of whether you felt supportive or whether you have relatives living nearby who could step in if the child was not well enough to go to daycare, for example. So I hope that gives you just a little flavour of the kind of work we were doing. So it's kind of very micro, but trying to take of the broader context of, you know, childcare policies, the workplace, and the national context, and national policies.
You know, you talked a lot about food insecurities. Can you explain to the audience a little bit more about low-income households and food insecurities, your findings there?
Yes, I mean, this was quite this again was an international study. And we were looking at food poverty, as we called it, after the global financial crisis. So we selected three countries. Two countries that were hit very hard by the financial crisis, Portugal and the UK, and a country which was much less affected. And we examined food poverty in terms of three dimensions: the material aspects of food, how much food you have, whether you go hungry or not, the quality of the food, the social aspects, whether you were enabled to be able to socialize with others in terms of food activities, like, you know, inviting people home and so forth, eating out with your friends and so on, and the emotional and psychological aspects of food to do with shame and stigma of not having enough to eat. So we looked at these kind of aspects, and we found, it's a very long, complex picture really, but in terms of the material aspects of food, across all three countries, we found that one of the ways that mothers managed food poverty was to go without food, to sacrifice their own food intake for their children, and to skip meals. We looked particularly at the role of school meals in mitigating food poverty, free school meals, and we found that in Portugal, free school meals were highly significant. They helped mothers to budget in the household, because they knew that their children were having a meal in the middle of the day. And because of Portugal's national policies on school meals, the children had a three-course meal in the middle of the day. And this is regulated in Portuguese legislation. And the meal has to consist of a proportion of protein, of fruit and vegetables, and always has to have soup to start with, things like that. So that was that helped to mitigate food poverty in Portugal. Whereas in Britain, although there is a free school meals policy, it's not a very adequate one. I mean, children, the allowance that children have doesn't really buy them a proper meal, for example. And in Norway, which is a rich country, they don't have school meals isn't available in most schools. There isn't a national policy of school meals. So it's again, the burden of school food is on parents. And although there wasn't a lot of food poverty in Norway, there were some families like new migrants who didn't qualify for the full welfare benefits available to those who've got a work record in Norway, that the burden of school food was quite considerable because food is extremely expensive in a country like Norway. And on the social dimensions of food poverty, we found that a third of parents said they couldn't afford to allow their children to have their friends home for something to eat. And the same proportion of young people said they couldn't socialize with their friends if it involved any activities that involve food or eating or anything to do with spending money. And in a way, the emotional dimension of food poverty was the saddest part of our study, especially for children. Some of the children described feeling different or excluded or ashamed because they'd no money to socialize with their friends or in other ways. And one boy who was the son of a migrant who had no, whose family had no, was not allowed to get any benefits from the state because they didn't have settled status in Britain. He described his shame at having to hide in the school library at lunchtime because he wasn't eligible for a free school meal and had no money. So those kinds of things were pretty shocking, really.
Now, what can a researcher learn about families by using the life story analysis?
Well, I want to emphasize two aspects to it. First, if you ask people in research to tell their life story, it allows you to put their life in historical context. And it also allows you to compare their lives with the lives of other people of a similar generation and a similar class and position, if you like. And family life stories, like all stories, are also narratives. They're given in response to the invitation to tell a story. And it's a performance. So as researchers, we have to be attentive to the fact that stories are told to and for audiences. And also to the point that people tell stories often because they have a story that they want to tell. And this is often related to some kind of major event in their lives or a rupture in their lives that they're trying to make sense of. So we also have to take account of these stories are not mirrors of the past. They're told from the vantage point of the present, the way people see them from the present, their present point in their lives, and also because they're having an eye to the future. So life stories tell us about identities, what people have become, who they are now, and who they'd like to be.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, life stories also tell us about what is not told, the silences, the events and phases in the life that they skip over or don't talk about. So they point to things that we need to think about or to ask about if they're not too sensitive or people want to talk about them. And I found the life story approach very useful in understanding families, especially when you can ask different generations in a family to tell their life stories. And you can identify then what values, what services, what support they pass on across the generations, and what they don't pass on, or what the new generation or the successive generation creates differently or creates anew. So it is life stories is a very useful way of looking at change and continuity in families.
Well, we've taken up a lot of your time. I've enjoyed our conversation. Can you tell the audience, what are you working on next?
Well, I'm sort of toward the end of a lot of things, but things pop up. But what I can say in these times of this dreadful pandemic, it's made me want to go on working with other people, albeit like talking to you often on Zoom. And I suppose to a large extent, if I'm going to go on working with other people, the topics are going to be, well, or the way we study them is going to be determined by them. But I'm not sure, but let's see. Let's see what the future holds.